This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The town of Normal saw an 8% drop in its crime rate last year, but it wasn't easy.
Kind of the story in 2016, one where we started off on a big spike, and, you know, we took some actions really to kind of turn that around, and one of the burglary category was one of those.
Hear about the annual crime report from Police Chief Rick Bleister, plus the Illinois Symphony strums with a Grammy-winning guitarist and a vigil for the budget. And a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington's crime rate dropped 5% last year overall, but the town of Normal had a very good year as well. We talk with Police Chief Rick Bleichner about Normal's crime trends.
We were down about 8% for 2016 compared to 2015. And then if you look at our Part 1 crimes, which are typically the more serious crimes, those were down a little bit compared to 2015 as well for 2016. And I think in looking at the five-year average, it was the second lowest, only following 2013, and it was pretty comparable. It was a little bit higher, but again, it was, we're talking 40 or 50 crimes, not hundreds of crimes.
There are always year-to-year aberrations because some of the data sets are fairly small, and that can result in fairly sizable percentage swings. And in a town the size of Normal's, there can be a few bad actors who account for a significant number of crimes, and when they're locked up, that category goes down. Residential burglaries is one of those in the past that's mm-hmm. had. Are there anything of note in that kind of happening in the last year?
As much as we try and be proactive in some things with education on different stuff, we are still a lot reactive when we're looking at crime data that comes in, whether it be on a daily basis or a weekly basis, and looking at, is that average? Is that normal? Are we having spikes in certain areas of town? And so, again, we spend a lot of time looking at that. So, to your point, you know, there certainly were times, for example, last year and beginning of 2016, we started off probably February and March in a spike, especially in the burglary categories. A lot of that was driven by there were a tremendous amount of vehicle burglaries that were going on out there. So we kind of looked at it, determined where we could make differences, where we could do some education, found that a lot of, you know, 90-some percent, almost 98% of the vehicle burglaries that were happening were unlocked vehicles. And so we tried to educate people on those. We went into certain areas of town where those were occurring. And then we also took some proactive steps, too, in having some additional enforcement details out there looking for those kind of violations. And you're right, you get a group of individuals. It's usually not one, but a group of individuals who you're able to take into custody, and you clear up a whole bunch of them, then you find that they kind of return to what the normal is. And so that was kind of the story in 2016, one where we started off on a big spike, and, you know, we took some actions really to kind of turn that around. And one of the burglary category was one of those overall that saw a pretty drastic reduction last year.
What did the index crime show in terms of increase or decrease?
I think overall there was a decrease in 16 compared to 2015. The majority of those were in that burglary and theft categories where we saw some pretty sizable decreases. We did see some increases in the areas of the aggravated assault or battery categories and in the robbery categories. But again, those are kind of smaller in number when they're reported.
Is the increase in robbery related to drug addicts needing cash?
You know, I would say I look at it and I think it's pretty cyclical. I mean, you could certainly make that argument that it could be somebody who's down on their luck, who obviously somebody who gets to a point where they want to go into a store or go into an establishment and use force to take money and commit a pretty serious crime is going to have to be in a frame of mind that we're probably you and I aren't familiar with. But I would think that in looking at it, although last year was a little bit of an uptick, you compare it to previous years and it's really about on par with that. So I would say it's kind of one of those give and takes when you look at it across the board. Last year was a little bit up in that area. Previous years we've had it where it was down. I don't know that there's anything that's really that would tie it to that. I mean, again, we've had a little bit of an increase in some of the hybrid gang activities throughout town, which could lead to some of that. Individuals who want to make a name for themselves, or as you mentioned, someone who wants to go in and just needs the money to either feed their family or feed their addiction. But the good thing in that is, although it is a very dangerous situation during those times, we had, you know, no serious injuries as a result of that during the course of the year.
Your counterpart in Bloomington, Chief Hefner, mentioned that there had been an effort to address some of the hybrid gang activity by cracking down on some actual juveniles that were trending that way, and that resulted in some modest reduction in shootings in the latter part of the year. The early part of the year was shooting heavy in Bloomington. How are you tackling the hybrid gang activity? What are you targeting?
Okay. Well, I mean, certainly when we're looking at that, we're looking at crimes of violence. And early in 2016, I think over the course of about a month and a half period, we had seven incidents, what we would consider legitimate, either shooting or shots fired where we got there. There's either evidence of shots being fired, witnesses actually testified to that or made statements that they saw weapons being used. And so we tried to dial down on those pretty quickly. I mean, with the use of just kind of community awareness, but also with retasking our investigations division, our problem-oriented policing division or group, and our patrol divisions, just sharing the information and having them be out in the communities looking at those kind of things. And obviously some of those players that come from one to the other and you kind of get to know those individuals, then we start looking at them. You know, is it a matter of just the wrong place, wrong time, or are they now actually an active individual in those? And so once we sort through those, that's where the investigation division comes into play and a lot of those interviews and follow-ups and stuff, because we think, you know, you make an arrest or two in those cases where you might have some of them that are linked together and you take one or two people off the street, all of a sudden they stop or they go down to nothing. And so that's what we found earlier in the year last year was with those, out of those seven incidents in Normal, and I think Bloomington had certainly a higher level in just when we were able to kind of focus in on it and remove a couple of those individuals from the street that were players in those, they seem to really stop.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're speaking with the police chief in the town of Normal, Rick Bleichner. Another area where addiction tends to stimulate crime is shoplifting. As people have an addiction, they need money to feed it. They look for first nonviolent ways and may eventually, if they get desperate enough, go to violent ways of generating money. So a lot of property loss in businesses tends to be tied to that. What did you see last year?
No, I would actually say our numbers, I think, with relation to that were pretty consistent with past years. I mean, you're right when you look at it. That's probably the most common theme is that individuals who either have an addiction, they take something, they steal it, they take it to the pawn shops or another location, try and sell it on Craigslist to get whatever money they can, and then use that to turn it around and feed their addiction. But we work pretty closely through our community service unit with loss prevention associates throughout different businesses in town to make them aware of that and you know, try and share that information. I can tell you, too, that sometimes that's a double-edged sword because, you know, a business who may then become a little more proactive, all of a sudden you start to see your numbers start to really increase in that area. And it's not necessarily a sign that there's more crime there. It's just that those businesses are doing a little better job about detecting them and stopping people and then contacting us. Because, you know, there's a fair amount, obviously, that we get called on, but there are some that don't even reach a certain threshold that the stores handle themselves, ban people from the stores, and don't even bother calling us on.
Who are the major drivers in town for that kind of report?
As far as the retail thefts, the majority of them are what I think you would probably expect. The larger stores, you know, your larger retailers, your Myers, your Walmarts, things like that, who have a variety of different, you know, goods to sell. And they have the most, I would say, a higher number than a lot of the other businesses and just customers through there in a daily basis. And those are the ones who we typically tend to get more calls from. Again, doesn't mean that they've got a bigger problem. It's just the volume of people through there in any given day is higher than a lot of other businesses.
How much of your total demand for service goes to the bigger places, the Myers and Walmarts?
Oh, I wouldn't say that it's, I mean, a large amount. I don't have that number right off the top of my head. But again, when you look at the retail thefts, you know, again, I mentioned the Meijer and the Walmart. Surprisingly, we get a fair amount of calls from Menards, people taking products and tools and things like that there. So, you know, the whole goal there for us is when people call, we respond. And that's, again, whether it's a small business or a large business.
Yeah, in some cities, it's a major drain on police time. Mm-hmm. Can you estimate how much it is in Normal?
And looking at it in the grand scheme of things, as far as our calls for service, it's not something that takes up or takes time away from our other needs and other patrol activities. There's still, you know, a fair amount of time in which our officers have that is non-obligated during the day in which they can use as discretionary to do other patrols and stuff like that during the course of the day.
Each year tends to inform the next one in priorities and tweaks in the attention that patrol officers are asked to give to certain things. How are you reconfiguring this year based on last year's numbers?
Well, I mean, some of the things we look at, obviously, we don't – a lot of it, like I mentioned before, is reactive. So, obviously, we're still – as much as we try to be proactive, we're still largely reactive. When the community calls us, we respond and make determinations there. When we look at our last year, you know, what the crime trends were and things like that, again, we certainly look – we still want to focus on the violent crimes where we can make differences and looking at that, especially the burglaries and those kind of things, because you can kind of, there's enough of those that occur that you can kind of pattern those and draw some analysis from them. Whereas if you have, you know, 30 robberies in the course of a year, and some of those, when we say robberies, aren't necessarily somebody going into a store with a gun. That could be somebody who's walking down the street and grabs their cell phone and takes it, considered a strong-armed robbery. So they're a little bit more difficult to pattern when you've got, you know, a small number like that. But for us, we tend to look at that, again, trying to be proactive and looking at ways in which we can work with the neighborhoods, work with the citizens to find out some of those things and some of the trends that are going on. Again, the burglary areas, we work with our community service officer and working through the loss prevention departments. We work with them pretty extensively. And then again, a lot of it is just using that information and trying to determine, you know, how the patrol staff can utilize their staffing a little bit better on those. Then we look at it as far as some of the things that are a little bit easier to predict. And I say easier to predict, but traffic crashes were up a little bit last year compared to prior years. So that's one of the things when we start looking at the causes for the traffic crashes. Most of them are what you would typically expect. They're speed related. They're distracted driving related. There are people who are turning in front of other vehicles when they don't have the right of way. So we kind of look at that information and determine where the most of those accidents are occurring, and then we try and put together plans that will focus on those kind of violations in the areas where we're having the crashes.
Okay, where should I stay away from?
Well, a matter of fact, we're doing some distracted driving initiatives. Some of those major intersections along Veterans Parkway, which partly because of volume, we have more traffic crashes, but also because some of the speeds are a little bit higher out there. On Veterans, it's 45, and typically when you've got a higher speed limit, those crashes, when they do occur, more likelihood for injuries. And so we're looking partly at the number of crashes, but also those areas where we've got personal injury accidents. Some of that appears to be on Veterans Parkway. Your other main thoroughfare is Main Street, but that doesn't mean that you should drive down College on your cell phone either, because, again, that's kind of one of the things with the slight increase in traffic crashes. We're really just trying to look at how we can make the roads a little safer out there.
Rick Bleichner is the police chief of the town of Normal. Crime in Normal dropped about 8% in 2016. Hear more from Chief Bleichner next week about the town's pilot project for officer body cameras.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a strike on an Illinois university campus. Diane Schultz of the Baby Fold was among 19 church, government, education, and social service representatives who were part of a community event last night of listening and prayer following 2 years without a state budget. Schultz read from the preamble to the Illinois Constitution and then began questioning how the state is living up to the obligation outlined in the document. The Baby Fold provides adoption and foster care, residential treatment, special education, and a variety of services to support families and children. Let's hear from Schultz, who outlined some of the serious consequences to those her agency served.
There are increased calls from families to the mental health crisis team. Wait times for these families to have a crisis worker arrive at their door has increased sometimes up to 4 hours for a social worker or clinician to make it to the home to try to help. And there are instances where caregivers of mentally unstable youth have had to wait days for the crisis team to find an available inpatient psychiatric hospital bed for a child or teenager because there was not a single bed to be had in the state of Illinois to provide that safety and stability for these youth in crisis. This is really where I want to highlight, you know, how do we help individuals develop their fullest potential? And you would have thought that there was some choreographing of statements that have already been made, but there has not been. This is where this partnership between government, education, and support services to children and families is really illustrated. Lack of family stability and unmet mental health needs creates huge barriers for children and youth to attend and succeed in school. A recent statistic from the National Institute of Mental Health cites that 37% of students with mental health conditions age 14 and older drop out of school. This is the highest dropout rate of any disability category. We are all called to deliver on these principles of well-being and opportunity for ourselves and our posterity. Who is our posterity? The Baby Fold's 115 years old, and there's a story back in our history about how one of our organizational leaders brought the babies that needed to be adopted and taken in to move the congregation they were speaking to action. Well, I don't have live babies to bring, but we have some really great photos of the faces that are being served by our school districts and our social service agencies in this community. This is our posterity, and they often don't have a voice of advocacy like so many other lobbying groups or people of power and influence. And these are the individuals that we are calling you to action in both prayer and by raising your voices to make sure that we can deliver on the principles included in our Constitution. Thank you.
Diane Schultz is with the Baby Fold. In between times of sharing, local clergy led prayers for the people and organizations impacted, as well as prayers for a breakthrough in the budget stalemate that has lasted 674 days, more than 22 months.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In just a bit, we'll hear from the conductor of the next Illinois Symphony Orchestra concert. The University of Illinois at Springfield tenure and tenure track faculty are on strike. The union representing about 170 professors has been negotiating for months, trying to come to terms on its first contract with the school. The union members authorized a strike a couple of weeks ago. Lynn Fisher, president of the UIS United Faculty Union and an associate sociology and anthropology professor, talked with IPR's Dusty Rhodes about the issues that led to the walkout.
We are the lowest paid public university faculty in the state of Illinois, and we've begun talking about those issues. But our key points right now are really about the kind of due process in the area of promotion and tenure that will help UIS build a strong, stable faculty. You know, behind any strike, there will always be multiple issues. And our many years where salaries are not keeping pace with inflation has led to faculty frustration, no doubt about that. But the reason we're on strike today is not directly because of our negotiations about salary or other economic issues. It's about some conversations we've been having with the university about due process in critical areas for faculty careers, reappointment and tenure. We went in hopeful after a very hard working weekend. We went in hopeful on Monday morning to work for Common Ground. But by the end of the day, the university came back with positions that we simply couldn't accept. And basically, I would say they're challenging, the way I heard it, is they're challenging our right as a union to bargain with them about these critical working conditions issues for faculty, due process in the tenure and promotion area.
What I was told before was that you were mainly trying to reinstate the agreement that faculty had back when this was Sangamon State University. And the administration has sent an email to everyone saying that the way that your union wants to blend tenure, the tenure process into your contract is unacceptable and non-conventional. It's unusual. Is the process that you guys are asking for, was that the process that was in place when it was Sangamon State?
No, not at all. And let me be clear, I saw that message from the university and I thought it was misleading in many ways. What we have been proposing has never been to go back to the SSU contract. What we're proposing is to have fair recognition in our contract that our current personnel policies will be honored under the period of the contract and that it will be that policy that creates clear standards that faculty are accustomed to for reappointment, tenure, and promotion. So all we're asking for is that the current policy be fairly recognized in the contract, not that we're going somehow back into the past, which is a message I've heard as well and is completely inaccurate. But there's a second very important piece to this, and that is that we need due process on the occasions when a faculty member has a sense that something's gone sheaf in their tenure process, that that there was a procedural issue that may have affected a decision of non-reappointment or denial of tenure or promotion. Now, the university has said, basically, you're quite right, that they don't want to work with the union on these issues, and they've made that clear again and again. But these are mandatory subjects of bargaining. And the vast majority of faculty contracts not only have, one of their primary reasons for existence is to establish clear standards, clear, reliable standards for promotion, tenure, and reappointment that give faculty the stability that they need to build careers, and due process associated with potential procedural issues in that process.
So that's the case at the flagship campus as well?
No, and so as you may know, the tenure track faculty on the, I assume you're referring to the UIUC campus, are not in a union. The non-tenure track faculty are organized. At the UIC campus, our sister campus in Chicago, both tenure track and non-tenure track faculty are in a union. And in fact, in those cases as well, the university has insisted on excluding some very common due process practices in their contracts. Now, the thing is that if that's what those unions bargained into their contracts, that's their issue. And we'd have to talk to them about, you know, why they agreed to that. What's going on now is we're being told, fundamentally, that we are a very small cog in a very big system. And that because that issue was addressed in different ways on the other campuses when they bargained their contracts, that the university doesn't have to talk to us about these critical issues, which are so important to our faculty. And we simply don't accept that argument.
Why are you doing this now? It's the week before finals, and if I can imagine that students getting ready to take their final exams mm-hmm. and expecting a review session or something like that might be a little upset by this. So why now?
Well, one thing is, I will say, we've been very heartened by strong statements of support from students on campus within our classes and through people posting on our Facebook site and so forth. So we think that most students understand why we're doing this. Faculty have worked hard to talk to students in their classes and to put out information. This is a kind of lesson, too, you know, what is a union? What's the value of a union to a university? And what are the conditions under which union members need to exercise their legal right to go on strike? And what are we trying to achieve? So faculty all across the campus have been talking to their students about this, and we're getting a lot of support from students. And we really invite students to come and stand beside us and learn what our issues are, talk directly to faculty on the picket line. And we have some students right now out there on the picket line marching with us and offering their support.
What are you expecting from your non-union colleagues, like your, you know, adjunct professors and graduate assistants? Are they expected to honor the strike, or what are they supposed to do?
We certainly hope that that all of our colleagues across the campus will do what they can to support the faculty in this case. We understand that the civil service staff who are in a union are not able to strike, but as I understand it, they're perfectly free to come and picket with us during their off-duty hours, and we would welcome them and any other support they're able to offer. And examples are they can wear a green UPI ribbon. Civil service staff on this campus are part of the same statewide University Professionals of Illinois local. So we share that commitment to union as a way of strengthening the UIS campus.
Lynn Fisher is a UIS professor and president of the UIS United Faculty Union, which is now on strike. However, students are still being told to report to class, as not all who teach on the campus are members of the union. The university spokesman released a statement saying negotiations had been progressing and called the strike a disappointment. The two sides are supposed to meet again on Friday. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A Grammy Award-winning guitarist is performing with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in Bloomington this evening. Jason Vio will give his interpretation of the Concierto de Aranjuez by Joaquin Rodrigo. Music director, candidate, and conductor Andrew Sewell joined us to talk about that work and the Carnival Overture by Antonin Dvorak, composed when Dvorak was 50 and just about to take a position as the head of a conservatory in New York.
Well, I guess it's getting close to, you know, to the mature Dvorak, and, you know, the New World Symphony was shortly after that. So I don't know. I think you hear the fully mature Dvorak at the peak of his, artistic, you know, goals. There are those that he made a number of what we would call symphonic poems, like The Wood Dove and those sorts of other lesser known, you know, orchestral pieces of the same length but not given the title of overture. And definitely Carnival stands out as one that's got a very familiar and memorable opening, and the tunes are just classic Dvorak, full of life and beauty, and really he's just the songwriter. I mean, he's like a Schubert of the romantic.
Different festival motifs, a lonely wanderer, a pair of straying lovers. How does that all jumble together?
Well, structurally, it's got a start and a finish. You know, we open with the opening theme, and then it's almost like a mini sonata form overture. But it definitely is crafted in a way that it's compact, and you never get too far away from the main themes. He doesn't kind of get lost in the structure. So I think at the same time it gives an opportunity for all the other various instruments to shine and come out, and fills out the overture.
Also on the docket is the Concierto de Aranjuez by Joaquin Rodrigo. This was written in 1939, just post-Spanish Civil War. Mm-hmm. How does that inflect the work?
You know, it was at a time when, sure, there was a lot going on in the world, and he was doing a lot of writing influenced by the guitar and by which is the native instrument of Spain, of flamenco. He has a number of compositions, such as the Concierto de Te, the Violin Concerto, the Concerto for Four Guitars, the Andalus Concerto, the Fantasia for a Gentleman, besides Aranjuez. And I've particularly enjoyed some of his string pieces as well. He's got a plethora of compositions. This is his most famous piece. But he continued composing all the way up into his 90s. But in 1939, it was a time of turbulence, for sure. The world was entering the Second World War. This came at a cost of his personal life. I mean, they'd just lost a child. The wife had gone through, a miscarriage, and this was his way of comforting her and writing this music, kind of put, and as a himself suffering loss. Sometimes you can't verbalise grief, and it all poured into this wonderful melody, which is based upon the bells of Aranjuez, you know, the village. The central movement, the second movement, of course, is the one with the beautiful solo. What's curious about Rodrigo's music is he's never too far away from the mixed meters, you know. The two against three, you know, da 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 da. So it's interesting for the orchestra to play. It requires some temperament as far as the strength of the orchestra against the guitar. We always get asked about the amplification of the guitar. You know, it's an acoustic instrument. It's got a small sound. What do you do in a big concert hall? Every guitarist that I've known has always had a little bit of amplification.
Is that something, though, that you manage as a conductor with in reining the orchestra back, or is that something that Rodrigo managed with the instrumentation at the points where the guitar pops?
I think he certainly wrote it acoustically, and in modern day, I mean, you can reduce the size number of the strings, or I've done it four or five times, and the guitarists, just so that they don't have to work super hard to get the volume, they can step back and do a few more nuances without worrying about being heard. I think it's I just did it in January, and the critic criticised the guitar solos for using an amplification and went off about it being steely sound and everything. I didn't think so. I mean, even Sharon Isbin and any of the major guitarists, Manuel Boreco, for example, Christopher Pike, and John Williams even worked with them all, they use amplification. I'm really looking forward to meeting and working with Jason Few. I've heard great things about him.
Is it a big romantic approach, or is it a restrained, let's be pure about the way this piece goes forward?
I think the intimacy is one of the things that I try to portray. Certainly the ease with which the English horn solo will play, and, you know, it can't be too slow because they'll run out of gas, you know, breath. It's a huge solo. And so there's a little bit of give and take, you know, where the orchestra comes in and the guitar might pull back and then the orchestra moves forward and propels it forward. There's a little bit of give and take.
They've got to be really watching each other.
Yeah, a lot of breathing, which music is all about breathing the phrase.
That's Andrew Sewell, one of the finalists for the job of music director of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra. You're listening to guitarist Pepe Romero. This evening, the performance will be by Grammy-winning guitarist Jason Vio. The Illinois Symphony Orchestra performs at 7:30 at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Central Illinois musicians remember one of their own. There's a growing push in Illinois to make the state the next to legalize recreational use of marijuana. Columnist Charlie Wheeler writes about proposed legislation for Illinois issues. Daisy Contreras talked with him about it.
Similar bills, I guess for practical purposes, identical bills pending in the House and in the Senate that would legalize marijuana as a recreational drug, similar to what Colorado has, similar to what Oregon has. And the argument is that by legalizing marijuana use under tight conditions, strictly regulated, we could tax it, we could stop wasting our law enforcement resources on going after pot users and instead focusing them on violent criminals. By legalizing the drug, we would do away or severely limit the black market, which now leads to gang warfare, criminal activity, sort of similar to what occurred during the years when Prohibition, in theory, banned alcohol in this country. And yet alcohol was readily available, and it led to the rise of criminal gangs and all kinds of violence. And so the theory is that if we were to legalize marijuana, we wouldn't have to worry with law enforcement resources being given to chasing after pot dealers. And at the same time, legalized marijuana might help to stop the opioid abuse, where folks are taking prescription drugs that they get one way or the other that have ingredients similar to heroin, and they're overdosing. And it's become a real crisis. Marijuana would be a way around that in the argument of the people who are pushing it. And it could produce some revenue for the state of Illinois. And heaven knows, we certainly need all the bucks we can get.
And in your column, you also called the proposal to legalize the use of recreational marijuana to be problematic. Why is that?
I think it would be problematic because you're going to have a hard time getting lawmakers to vote for it. On a practical level, I don't see it as being causing that much problem. And as a matter of fact, there was a Paul Simon Public Policy Institute poll that came out that found roughly two-thirds of the respondents thought we should legalize marijuana and regulate it the same way we do alcohol. And I think the idea that that's been used in the past, that, oh, marijuana is a gateway drug and it has all these terrible side effects, I don't think that that's particularly effective anymore. And as the sponsors point out, and I agree with this, we spend an awful lot of time chasing down pot dealers, burning down fields of wild marijuana. And I think those resources could be better used going after some of the real criminal elements in society, the people who do traffic in the hard drugs like heroin or like methamphetamine.
And you mentioned that it will be a while before we see votes on these bills. Sponsors of these bills are not currently pushing for votes to happen. Why is that?
Yeah, and I think part of it is a question of educating people. And that's what they have said at the time they introduced the legislation. They hope to have a number of hearings across the state at which people could come forward, learn about the pros and cons, and from the sponsor's point of view, maybe find tweaks that could be made, amendments that could be made to the legislation that would maybe encourage other lawmakers to vote for it. And at the moment, their judgment is, and I think they're correct, those votes aren't there yet. And so they're going to try educating people. They're going to try seeing, are there some changes that we can make that would make you, as my colleague in the Senate or in the House, be willing to vote for it, which is the way the process is supposed to work. There's supposed to be compromise so that you can arrive at a public policy that everyone is comfortable with. Not everyone, but a majority of the people in the Senate and in the House are comfortable with.
Charlie Wheeler is with the University of Illinois at Springfield. He spoke with Daisy Contreras for Illinois Issues. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to the music of the trio Bushrock, featuring keyboard player Delmer Brown. The Central Illinois Music Community is holding a jam session for Brown Sunday evening at Jazz Up Front in downtown Bloomington. The Bloomington High grad died earlier this year of cancer. He was 62. After graduating from Boston's Berklee School of Music in the late 1970s, Brown went on to play alongside some of the biggest jazz, rock, and R&B names in the world, including Miles Davis, Sting, Herbie Hancock, Peter Gabriel, and Bruce Springsteen. Bloomington native and fellow musician Chuck Tripp befriended Brown as a teenager. They remained lifelong friends. Tripp talked with GLT's John Norton from his Chicago home about Brown and how they first met.
You know, both of us being musicians, you know, we both had such a deep love for music. I think he heard about me, and then I think he came over to my house or something.
What street did you grow up on?
East Oakland.
And what street did he grow up on, do you know?
He grew up on Mill Street on the west side.
You guys got to know each other musically.
Tell you the truth, I can't really remember 100%. Because he's a couple years younger than me. You know, and I had to be about maybe 15 or 16 years old then. And I've been playing for a few years, and, you know, he's already kind of a seasoned musician, you know. And we just kind of got together and took off from there, you know.
I was really surprised when I heard that he died that I really didn't know who Delmar was. And when I asked around the radio station around town a little bit, there's a lot of people who didn't know. He was known fairly well in the tight little music circles, but outside of that, he wasn't anywhere near as well known as he should have been, considering his stature, you know, musically, you know, in this country. Why wasn't he better known, even around here in Central Illinois?
Well, you know, it's kind of like maybe if he was like a straight-up like pop musician or something, he would have been more well-known. But it's like in jazz, you know, it's kind of like an underground thing. You know, it's not really a super popular music, so a lot of great people go undetected. You know, it's like the average person out there in the streets, they don't know nothing about Charlie Parker or Coltrane or Charlie Mingus or any of those guys. And these guys were total music geniuses.
And he ended up playing with some of those musical geniuses like Miles Davis and Quincy Jones and people like that. That's what I'm getting at is, you know, I understand his solo career, you know, wasn't a well-known one nationally, but boy, he played with the biggest names in music.
He did. Yes, he did.
Did he ever talk to you about his time with Miles Davis, Quincy Jones?
You know, he went to college over at ISU, you know, and I think he kind of overwhelmed him with his musicianship or something, you know. I'm pretty sure Frank Stokes or somebody suggested that he went to Berklee. So he went out to Boston, and he went to school at Berklee. And he called me up a couple of times and said, hey, man, You ought to come out here, man. There's a lot of gigs. I wound up going out there, too, maybe a couple of years after he had already been there. You know, so we were pursuing music careers, and we was kind of like joking back and forth. We had another roommate, a guy from the Virgin Islands. His name was Hugh Peterson. And we was all kind of talking to each other. We was wondering who was going to be one of the first people to get out there and maybe, you know, play with some of the professional people out there. The guy, Hugh Peterson, he was a drummer. He kind of auditioned with the Weather Report. You know, he was all glad. You know, all happy about it. But he didn't make it with the band. He didn't make it. You know, I think Peter Erskine got the gig. But then maybe about a year or two later, Dumba got like an audition with Pat Martino. And he made it. You know, I mean, it was a big deal out in Boston. You know, at least with a lot of his jazz musicians and all the people that knew Dumba. So he took off from that. And I think he worked with a whole bunch of different groups, one of them, Jaco Pastorius, and a whole bunch of other people. He would talk to us about them. So I guess a few years went by, and I came back to Bloomington for a minute and just kind of pursued a local musical career and then played a few other towns. I moved to Champaign, and he kept growing and growing. And the next thing, it's like I moved to Chicago, and he called me up one day and said, "Hey, man, I'm playing with Sting now." You know, I said, "Wow." I was just totally floored. And he got us, I think he got me, his mom, and my mom, and my brothers and sisters. He must have got about 20 tickets, you know, backstage passes, man. It was like absolutely phenomenal.
John Norton talking with Chuck Tripp, who knew Delmar Brown very, very well. He played music with him growing up in Bloomington, and they stayed in touch until Delmar passed away earlier this year. Well, you mentioned a couple of names, you know, Sting and, Weather Report and, just all these different names, Miles Davis we talked about. Delmar had his own career as well as a solo artist, but he was mainly known for some of the bigger names that he has played with, and that include Bruce Springsteen and Peter Gabriel, among others. Was he more comfortable in the role as a sideman, or was it just the money was good enough that pursuing that solo career was probably a back shelf thing for him?
I think he was pretty much satisfied with trying to do both. I mean, I think anybody in their right mind, if you have an opportunity to get out there with a big star, you know, it not only helps you financially, but it helps your career out. You know, because like you can put those people on your resume. You know, when people find out that you played with Sting, then it makes it easier for you if somebody else calls you, because you've already been out there, you're already exposed.
Did he ever tell you a great story or two that you can share with us on the radio about maybe playing with some of those bigger names, whether it's Miles or Yasu Endower or Quincy Jones or whoever it might have been?
Well, the only thing that I thought was kind of interesting was, I guess it was the night after he played with Sting, he invited me to, he was staying at the Ritz-Carlton downtown in Chicago. And I went up to his room, you know, and it's like, he was living like a rock star. Had a huge hotel room, it was like really, really decked out and everything. But he was telling me about Sting, he said, you know, because a lot of times you just take it for granted, you know, big stars, you know, life is like, you know, it's real easy and it's real nice for him. But he told me that Sting really couldn't really go out in the daytime. He said a lot of times he would just go out and hang out at night, just run the streets kind of a lot more free than he could in the daytime, because people would probably swarm him, you know, in the daytime, you know. I thought that was kind of interesting.
What, in your mind, made Delmar Brown so special?
You know, Delmar was really a genius, I think. It's like when we were kids, he would tell me, like, when we were in high school, we was playing with a group called Band X then.
This was at Bloomington High School?
It's Bloomington High School, yeah.
Okay.
And I'd ask him, well, what do you do? You know, we'd have a weekend off or something. I'd say, what are you doing this week? He'd say, oh, man, I want to go on this 24-hour sabbatical. And he would practice like the 24 hours straight almost. You know, maybe take a little cat naps, just learning different stuff. Like he might work on like Oscar Peterson stuff or work on Herbie Hancock stuff. You know, so like he was listening to like really super advanced music even back then. You know, a lot of us, I didn't understand a lot of it at first. You know, So he's really good. You know, he spent 24 hours learning a really difficult Jimmy Smith tune or something. He just was really dedicated to music.
Bloomington native Chuck Tripp talking about his lifelong friend and fellow Bloomington High School graduate, Delmar Brown. The Central Illinois Music Community is holding a jam session for Delmar Brown Sunday night in downtown Bloomington. Doors open at 5 p.m. The music you're hearing is the trio Bushrock, one of its final projects. The song is titled Towards the One. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Thanks as well to IPR, to John Norton, and Colleen Reynolds for today's show. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.